from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. Well, it's down to the wire, the final countdown, the last academic hurrah. College seniors across the country standing on the precipice of the real world, tirelessly working on the last great intellectual exercise of their undergraduate career, the senior thesis. Spending hours experimenting in the lab, studying fossils, sifting through documents in dusty library stacks, even watching hours of cable news. Well, this hour on Point, an academic tour de force, college seniors sharing the rewarding highs and frustrating lows of crafting the senior thesis. You can join us on air or online. College seniors, are you slamming into the deadline? Long ago thesis writers, do you even remember yours? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me along for the ride this hour from Washington is McKay Coppins, staff writer for The Atlantic and fellow graduate of my alma mater, Brigham Young University. McKay, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, Jane. Good to be here.
This will be a lot of fun. You ready?
I am. I'm excited.
Okay, let's go first to the University of Vermont and to Caleb Wynn. He's a neuroscience major from Natick, Massachusetts. His thesis is titled, get ready for it, Viral Vector-Mediated Indirect Pathway Upregulation in the Dorsolateral Striatum. There's more. A discussion on basal ganglia habit and goal-directed circuits. Caleb, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. That title takes up half my page here. So give us the English translation. What were you trying to explain or prove in your senior thesis?
Yeah, absolutely. So our lab works on habit, and we believe there's a finite number of pairings for an individual before any behavior becomes habitual. And our goal is to try to find out where that number lies, where that number of the classic example is cigarettes lies before a certain number of cigarettes becomes habitual and you no longer think about performing that action.
Ah.
So in this piece of work, I've tried to clarify where that line might be and how we might be able to shift that line for individuals who might be experiencing drug addiction.
So did you find the line? Where is it?
Well, we're using an animal model, so it's not quite transferable to humans yet,
okay.
But it's getting very close, and our results are pretty compelling.
So give us some of your results. I mean, this research is particularly relevant in the context of drug addiction, right, in the United States?
I think drug addiction is one of the most relevant applications for this research at the moment. And currently, we've been studying how to increase the number of reinforcers necessary so that we can prevent habit for longer. And this goes off of the idea that the literature says there's a race between two lines of communication in the brain, one that promotes habit and one that combats habit. So our research improves the line of communication that combats habit by strengthening it and increasing its speed so that we can outcompete habit for longer.
So habit and behavior, different things. You're trying to identify the difference between those.
Habit, we're trying to identify the difference between habit and when habit can still become a conscious decision.
Mm. So what got you interested in this particular topic, Caleb?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think overall, drug addiction is a huge issue, especially in the United States right now. We have a lot of news about opioids, and I think that if we're able to step back a little bit and understand how people may get involved and experience drug addiction just on a systemic behavioral level, then we can have much, much better clinical interventions in the future.
Tell me about your time in the lab, because I know your thesis was quite hands-on, more hands-on maybe than we might hear about. Tell us about your experience in the lab and what that yielded for your thesis.
Absolutely. So I've been working on this specific paper. It's a culmination of about 2.5 years of collecting research. It began with trying to find out where that threshold is for behavior, and that took about a year to run through a few different subjects. And now we are trying to find out how to turn this into a piece that we can then pass off to many clinical neuroscientists who are working on a more human model. And it's been a very fun time, personally and professionally, working with this lab. I think that we're on the forefront of some of this behavioral research, which definitely helps the personal aspect as well. It gives a lot of meaning to the work.
McKay Coppins is with me here from The Atlantic. Caleb, I'm hearing some interesting practical applications here. McKay, jump in.
Yeah, well, my question was, you know, as it applies to the opioid epidemic, which we've heard a lot about, you've seen a lot of reporting about how the initial wave of prescriptions for these opioids were rooted in kind of faulty research about how addictive they were. Talk a little about how this could be applied specifically to the opioid epidemic and how the medical community treats prescribing opioids.
Absolutely. Thank you, McKay. So the wave of prescriptions, I can't speak to the exact findings of the original research and why the prescriptions went up, but what we do see now is a lot of people who are addicted to these substances, and I think it's our responsibility as researchers to understand how we can break down this addiction, how we can understand what the individual who's experiencing addiction might have going through their brain as a decision driver for why they continue to experience this addiction, to seek this and to administer this this maladaptive drug and this behavior. So what we're trying to do is to help the individual who's experiencing addiction remain conscious over their behavior for more iterations of this behavior to help combat that for longer. Does that make sense, McKay?
Yeah, that's interesting. Thank you.
Caleb, thank you so much. Last question. I know you got to go here. What do you see yourself doing in 5 to 10 years? Applying this to actual patients?
Yeah, that's the goal. So I recently accepted a position in a private healthcare consulting company, and my goal in 5 years is to be able to bring behavioral changes that are very productive to a large scale, and hopefully take a crack at a lot of these epidemics.
Good for you. Congratulations and nice work. I bet it's glad you're done, right? Glad you're finished.
I'm excited. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you, Caleb, from the University of Vermont. Let's go to Howard University now. And Ketchy Norum, she's a journalism major from Huntsville, Alabama. The title of her college senior thesis is Coloring the Pitch, Exploring the Impact of News Coverage of Black Male Athletes' Branding Power. And Ketchy, welcome to the program. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
So this topic feels incredibly relevant given the recent controversies in the news. Tell us about your approach here. What were you trying to get at?
So my approach was I wanted to explore a topic that was really personable to me. So as a communications major who has a passion to work in sports, I wanted to tie the two together. So through conversation with just some of my friends as well as in class, and on Twitter, I was seeing that there is frustration with the imbalance of media reporting of black athletes. And I have also aspirations of, you know, working in PR in sports too. So I thought it would be best that I have a topic where I'm able to assess how reporting can affect a person's brand. Because trying to see how a viewer or consumer takes in that media perception and how it in turn can affect their buying power.
So to that end, give us the example that you studied of Josh Brown and Ray Rice, both perpetrators of domestic violence, and the difference between how they were treated in the media based on their brands?
Yes. So, I mean, obviously, if you look at Ray Rice and even the Josh Brown situation, the NFL tried to cover it up. However, when both were exposed, you saw that there is more negative. Well, first of all, there's just reporting on the Ray Rice scandal. And someone can say that, well, because there was a video, but still there's more reporting and then in turn negative reporting, as opposed to Josh Brown, who's, was white. And so maybe race played a factor as to why it's like, okay, this happened, but let's kind of still slide it under the rug. But with the Ray Rice scandal, you know, some people could say that, oh, they used it as an example.
McKay?
Yeah, Ketchy, can I ask you, did you notice any differences in the way black athletes were covered between sports, you know, football versus track and field versus basketball versus golf? You know, was the coverage different?
As a whole, yes. And I also believe that because the NFL or right now football is the prime sport in America, so that definitely plays a huge factor into how much reporting one, I feel like, is given to one sport over another, as well as I think the dynamic in race in each sport. So I think NBA or even in basketball, it's not as prominent as in the NFL, where, you know, some people say, well, there's mainly white quarterbacks who are looked as the leaders. And then the other players are not looked as leaders as so. But in basketball, there's a difference. So I definitely believe there was a nuance in reporting across sports.
What was the most alarming example of media bias that you found throughout your research?
I definitely think it was, even if we look at the players who decided to kneel during the anthem, DeValve from the Browns, he's a white player who kneeled. It was, they were inquiring, oh, why did you decide to kneel in solidarity with your teammates? But we can easily then say, well, Colin Kaepernick, Eric Reed, they are out of jobs. They have not yet been signed. Even Robert Griffin III was signed yesterday by the Baltimore Ravens. And if we compare stats, Colin Kaepernick has a better resume. Why has he not been signed? So we definitely see that the rhetoric and the perception has changed depending on race. And so we need to be questioning, especially as reporters who our job is for society as a whole, to hold people accountable, that we have to make sure that we are being objective and that we are not showcasing or inputting our bias, especially in, I think, highly politicized issues.
And Ketchy Norm, what a fascinating senior thesis. And thanks so much for being with us and sharing it. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Jane.
And Ketchy Norm from Howard University. She's going on to get her MBA. She says good luck to you, Ankiche. McKay Coppins is with us. Stick with us, McKay. We're going to move on to a break here. But when we come back, more senior theses. And listeners, we'd love to have you join. Did your college thesis launch your career? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking with the class of 2018 this hour about their senior theses, often the capstone of a college career, and you can join the conversation. Seniors, have you turned your thesis in? Are you still pushing toward the deadline? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Longtime friend of this program, McKay Coppins, staff writer of The Atlantic, is along for the ride this hour. McKay, great to have you.
Great to be here. These kids are intimidating, well-informed and smart.
Did you write a senior thesis? I got to ask. Do you even remember?
I was trying to think about it. I actually don't think I was required to.
Yeah.
And at the time, I'm sure I was very glad that I didn't have to, although now I kind of regret it.
Right. Let me get some callers in here. We have a lot lined up on my board that want to get in. Susan first in Sharon, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to share that I am a 1976 graduate of Barnard College.
Okay.
And what unfortunately stands out to me in my memories is the research on index cards, hours and hours in libraries that I'm sure is no longer done, and piles of very carefully organized index cards.
Let me guess, on a manual typewriter?
Indeed, and that was my next thing. Hours and hours. I was not a very good typist, and I just remember sitting there and just plowing through that. So just whatever else young people are doing these days, be very thankful for the computers, laptops, et cetera.
It could be worse, right? It could be worse.
Yeah.
Susan,
thank you
so much. I appreciate the memory. Let's go to Megan in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Megan. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to share a note of encouragement with all those students who are stressing through their theses right now. Back in 2001, I was finishing my master's thesis for the University of Mississippi. I was so stressed I had to adopt a dog from the shelter just so I would get up and take a break from the computer. But the good news is, 16 years later, this past summer, I was contacted via LinkedIn by a lawyer who was researching one of the properties included in my thesis, and wanted to see my original research and my photographs. And I was so delighted to share it with them. So that thesis had been dusty on the shelves for 16 years, and then someone found some use for it.
Something came of it. Oh, that's great. Megan, thank you very much. Let's get one more in here. Emily in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Emily. Glad you called.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Go ahead, please.
So I actually have a BA, an MS, and a JD, and I've never actually had to write a thesis. In my undergrad, only honor students had to write thesis. In my master's program, we actually had a practicum where we went to D.C. for a semester and worked in government agencies and organizations.
Mm. So do you feel like you missed out? You didn't get to write a senior thesis, Emily?
No, I honestly don't think I missed out at all, because actually in my while I was in law school getting my JD, we had to write several legal briefs, which are essentially, I want to say, large thesis research papers with a legal focus.
So you wrote more than your fair share is what you're saying. Emily, thank you so much for the call. Let me bring in our next student, our next senior from Vanderbilt University, Allison Cribb. She's an earth and environmental sciences major from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Allison, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, glad you're here. I'm going to let you read the title of your thesis. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the title of my thesis is Terminal Near Proterozoic Bioturbation and Implications for the Ediacaran Extinction.
I can't believe Jane didn't want to read that one.
One more time, Allison, just so we can get it.
Yeah, it's Terminal Near Proterozoic Bioturbation and Implications for the Ediacaran Extinction.
Okay, 2 years in the making, I understand this one is. Tell us what this is about.
Yeah, so what I'm working on is what caused the first mass extinction of complex life, or at least what we think is the first mass extinction of complex life. So the Ediacaran biota are these weird alien-looking organisms that dominated the biosphere about a little more than half a billion years ago. Sorry.
So the first complex multicellular life, that's what you were looking at.
But they go extinct. And no one's really sure why, but what we see at the same time is the evolution of ecosystem engineering behaviors.
Okay.
And in the simplest form, it's simply bioturbation. So it's just like a worm burrowing on the seafloor. But what that does is it disrupts the substrates that the Ediacaran biota lived on, so all the sediment at the seafloor, and probably had some biogeochemical changes. Basically would have stressed out the Ediacaran enough that it actually drove them to extinction. Mm. It's really important to understand if we want to know the subsequent radiation of complex life that we see in the Cambrian, that we see in the Cambrian explosion. And that's when we start seeing organisms that we actually recognize as similar to the ones that we see today.
Wow. So you're looking at whether this first burrowing creature caused the extinction of the biota.
Yeah,
essentially.
Tiny worms.
Wow. So you did some traveling for your thesis. Where'd you go, and how did that supplement your work?
Yeah, so I spent 2 field seasons in Namibia, which is a country in southern Africa. Mm-hmm. So the last 2 summers I've been out there, and basically what we do is we map our field sites, and we try to see what kind of rocks are there, because that's how we understand what kind of paleo environments we're looking at. And then we spend many, many days looking for millimeter scale fossils on these huge swaths of land, which can be kind of difficult, as you can imagine. That's why it takes so long to do this field work.
Wow. Pretty cool. McKay, what do you think?
Well, I'm wondering, going forward, do you want to continue this research, or is this a launching pad for a broader kind of research? What do you want to do going forward?
Yeah, so I've been really lucky to be accepted to a PhD program where hopefully I will be picking up this project but doing more geochemistry work with it to understand more of the nuanced environmental changes. But anything can happen in a PhD in geology, so that's kind of the plan right now. But in the next 5 years, like, I could be doing something a little bit different.
Maybe off to USC, is that what I'm reading here?
Yeah, the University of Southern California.
Good for you. Well, Allison, thank you very much for being with us and explaining this. All right, say it one more time just because it's fun to hear it, your title.
Terminal Near Proterozoic Bioturbation and Implications for the Ediacaran Extinction.
Awesome. Allison Cribb, thank you so much for joining us from Nashville. Let's get a caller in here, Ryan in Columbus, Georgia. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. So did you write a thesis, Ryan?
I did. I wrote a senior thesis when I graduated from a BA in history program about a year and a half ago on Italian-American anarchists and their response to the assassination of William McKinley. I've been pursuing American history kind of throughout my undergrad, and now I'm enrolled in a master's program at the same institution, and I'm looking more towards labor history, the Haymarket Affair. I come from a community that was a very big mill town, so there's a lot of resources here locally, mm-hmm. Based on the 1934 general textile strike, and I'm writing a paper currently about the emotions associated with labor. So it's a little bit nebulous of a topic, but it's quite interesting.
Oh, that's really neat. Thanks very much, Ryan, for the call. One more in here, Kim from Ferndale, Michigan. Hi, Kim, you're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I have just a bit of a sad story to share. I'm a teacher, and about 10 years ago, I was writing my master's thesis on Khan Academy, and it was 6 months in the making, probably the last few weeks, 80 hours a week, trying to get it finished up. And I dropped it off in my professor's office, and as I was going down, she was coming up the stairs and said hello, said I just dropped off my master's thesis. She said, great. Drove to work less than 10 minutes later. I went online, and she'd already posted my grade. Never even read it.
She never read it.
Well, what was your grade?
Yeah. I guess an A.
Oh, well, I guess it's okay then.
But all that work, and she never even read it. It was really disheartening.
Oh, dear. All right, Kim, thank you very much for the call. One more, Meredith in Augusta, Georgia. Meredith, did you write a thesis and did somebody read it?
I did write a thesis and someone did read it.
Okay, good.
So my thesis in undergrad was on neoliberalism and its effects on mass incarceration and how accurate, being the key word, education reform can decrease those rates, which is totally informed and definitely impacted what I do now. So I'm a teacher. Go figure. And it has been a little bit difficult because doing so much research on the political side and the social and economic side of what education should look like, could look like, has made it difficult now. But not in the sense of it's hard to be a teacher, but mm-hmm. having the knowledge that I have from my thesis has informed me and made me a better teacher. But it's definitely made it a little bit more difficult, if you know what I mean.
So it was worthwhile in some ways. Meredith, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Nice to have you. Let's get to our next thesis. Joining me now from the United States Military Academy at West Point is a thesis duo, Timothy Johnson, a history major from McKinney, Texas, and James Dobson, a human geography major from Bethesda, Maryland. And the title of their thesis is Ethnic Integration in the Bosnian Military. Great to have you both, Timothy and James. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
So what is your thesis about? Give us what it's about in a nutshell.
Yes, ma'am. So our thesis began with our relationship with the first Bosnian cadet at the United States Military Academy, talking about his home country and some of his experiences there.
Yeah, and so from that point, we were looking into we had to write a paper for our capstone officership course here at West Point. Called MX400. We're looking through ideas, and then we heard him talk about some of the situations in his country, and it seemed really intriguing to kind of learn about their armed forces and so the situation that goes on there. And so from that, we decided to go to the country and learn from his dad. He was a sergeant major in the Bosnian Army.
Wow. So you went to Bosnia. What did you do there? How'd you learn, and what made it into your thesis?
Yes, ma'am. So the first thing we did was we met with both the NATO commander, who is an American Air Force general officer, and the commander of the Peace Support Operations Training Center, which is commanded by the Bosnian-Herzegovina military. So one of the things that we noticed right off the bat was the difference between the three ethnic groups and their representation in their armed services. And so we asked them, how does your armed services integrate the former warring ethnic factions? And as we discovered, their armed services employ an ethnically locked leadership position. So if you want to be the, let's say, hypothetically, the battalion commander for 2nd Battalion, 1st Brigade, you know, infantry, and you were not Croatian, then you could not be that battalion commander. However, the executive officer and the operations officer were going to be Bosniak and Serbian, respectively, so that each command triad has equal representation among the ethnicities.
So that's so interesting, Timothy Johnson. So each military has its own leader within its own cohort.
So the Bosnian Herzegovinan military is united in that all three ethnicities serve under the same flag. That's been the case since 2006.
And just jump in, Jane. This is Tim, by the way. The interesting thing about it is following the Dayton Accords in the 90s after the Civil War is that they still have somewhat separate governments. And so you have the Federation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is composed of ethnic Bosniaks and Croats, but then you have the Republika Srpska, which has its own sort of autonomous government, and they all come together in Sarajevo. And so the big contention was back in 2006 is when they integrated the Army of the Republika Srpska and the Army of the Federation together. And so that was what required this sort of position locking as a means to ensure that the army would be a cohesive unit. And so far, it's been one of the biggest success stories of the country. There's still a lot of, you know, they say there's a lot of partisanship here. Well, the Bosnia-Herzegovina, the way they promote themselves in election cycles, as we found out when we were there, was rather than, oh, I'm the most, you know, Republican Democrat, it's by ethnicities rather than party lines. So in order to get elected, they have to show their how straight they are and how close they are to their people.
So James, how do you think this study will help you be a more effective officer after you graduate from West Point?
So the lesson of ethnic integration in the Bosnian Armed Services is an important one for understanding the civil military relationships. Tim and I both are the cadets in charge for the Center of Study of Civil Military Operations at West Point, and we study a lot of the effects of the military institution on the civilian institution. You know, the what impact does military operations have on the civilian populace? And so, the Bosnian Armed Service integration is widely regarded as one of the biggest successes of, you know, the formation of the state of Bosnia and Herzegovina after the Civil War in the 90s. So we wanted to take that and apply it to a similar operating environment where there are ethnic divisions like Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're addressing this model with some of the other situations that we face operationally.
Do you think this integration model could be used in Iraq, for example?
So this is what I'm looking at in particular, using history. So there's a potential, but I think part of the issue is just understanding the different people, the different histories. In particular, what I'm comparing and contrasting is kind of the legacy of Tito in former Yugoslavia on Bosnia and Herzegovina versus colonialism and Saddam's regime. And in particular, the contrast that I'm pointing out is that Tito stressed unity and brotherhood, and so that sort of stress of egalitarianism had its effect on Bosnia and Herzegovina versus in Iraq. And Iraq, you've got British with British colonialism and Saddam. You have one group sort of being put over the other in the case of Sunni, Shias, Kurds, and so how those sort of power dynamics ultimately played out, and how can they, you know, be overcome if you attempt to use such a model?
Well, Timothy Johnson and James Dobson, we're really grateful to have you here today from the United States Military Academy at West Point. I know you're going to be commissioned as second lieutenants in the Army for at least 5 years. So in advance, we're grateful for your service. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much, ma'am.
And I have to say, my husband went to the Naval Academy, so I cannot help myself go Navy. Tim and James,
wow,
thank you so much. McKay Coppin, stick with us. We're discussing the labor of love, sweat, and sometimes tears that goes into a college thesis. You can join the conversation. Did writing a senior thesis change your life? Do you even remember it? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking with some of the best and the brightest of the class of 2018 this hour about their senior theses, and you can join the conversation. Was your senior thesis a game changer long after graduation? A board full of calls. Let's go first to Steve in Arcadia, Oklahoma. Hi, Steve. I'm glad you called.
Hi, Jane. First, my senior honors thesis changed my life, academic life. It was no question. And I am so excited to hear the number of young people who have done senior theses and other theses, because it can literally change. My story, some 40-plus years ago, I was in the honors program at the University of Massachusetts.
Okay.
And, boy, that was one of the earliest honors programs, and I had to write a thesis. Well, I got involved with a group that was doing work with prostaglandins, which were very, very new at the time, and I ended up doing my senior honors thesis on the effects of prostaglandin E2-mediated hyperthermia. Hmm. In other words, prostaglandins caused fever. And I didn't know it at the time, but this was pretty much groundbreaking stuff, because it turns out when you take aspirin, it blocks prostaglandin E2.
Hmm.
And it was the first time we'd ever really shown that that was there. So anyway, then I went and got my PhD thesis, did more work on prostaglandins and the effects on the brain.
Yeah.
Did postdoctoral fellowships, then got a faculty position at a medical school. And it was a game changer.
Wow. Like, so it led to your career. And what do you do now? You're a medical professor?
Well, I'm retired now.
Yeah.
But, was for many years and did similar work, and it just absolutely changed my life. So I want to encourage lots of people who are thinking about maybe doing it, jumping in and just, and yes, manual typewriter, 3x5 cards.
You were there
in
too.
Library, yeah. Searching down,
It's easier now, that's for sure. Steve, thank you so much for the call. Let's get Gary in here from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Gary. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Echoing your previous caller about the wonderful opportunity it is as an undergraduate to do a thesis, and also based on my own experience. First of all, I think that it's really unusual to have the opportunity to go into such extensive depth in a subject. And if you don't do it as an undergraduate, you may never get a chance, unless you're going for a PhD, to do that
That's
kind of thing
point.
Again. Second of all, I think there's something really transferable to almost any career, which is that you need to put together and tell a very large, complex story. And it doesn't really matter what field you're doing that in. You will have to do that in most careers. In my case, it led to a career in journalism. I was writing a thesis on what was then an obscure colonial war in North Africa. And I became so fascinated with it that I applied for a fellowship to go abroad, which I did following college. I went to the countries involved, to the Western Sahara mm-hmm. and neighboring countries.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sparked my interest in covering this as a journalist. And over the next 20 years, I went back numerous times for American news organizations.
Wow.
And wrote about it.
Gary, thank you. What a great story. That was the seed that sparked many great things. I appreciate your call, Gary. Thank you. Let me bring in another senior here to tell us about their theses. From Florida A&M University, DeMarcus Robinson, an environmental science major from Atlanta, Georgia. His thesis is titled Electrospinning Polyethylene Oxide and Cyclodextrin, Derivatives for Oil Absorption. Great to have you, DeMarcus.
Hello. Hey, how are you doing today, Jane?
I'm doing really well. We're so glad to have you. I hear you created a fabric as part of your senior thesis, a material that absorbs oil out of the ocean. Tell us about this.
So pretty much I came up with this idea back when I was in high school, and I saw the effects of the deep water horizon back in like 2010. So I wanted, as I was coming to college, I wanted to do something about, making the ocean safer. And when it comes to oil spills, how can we effectively clean up the oil out of the ocean? in a time effective manner and mm-hmm. in a way that's cost efficient. And so through trial and error, I came up with designing material, like a fabric material, to absorb the oils.
Wow.
So the process. Oh, sorry.
Well, have you tested it? Do you know it works, DeMarcus?
Yes, I have. I've been working in the lab. And so I made the fibers, and then I actually did the oil absorption test, and it has absorbed some oil. And so I had recorded that data as well.
Wow. McKay.
So this is interesting. Do you see any way for this material to be, you know, produced on a mass scale or, you know, at the ready for future oil spills or anything like that? Or do you see obstacles in doing that?
I see as both. I can see that it can be produced on a mass scale, but there are many obstacles. The process of making the fibers is really sensitive. The process is called electrospinning, and it's very sensitive in the fact that you have to control the temperature, the humidity, the solvents you use to dissolve your chemicals, the distance, the conductivity, and all that matters in terms of making fibers. And then on top of that, when I go out to make the fibers, it takes about 3 to 5 hours to produce one sample of fibers on a plate.
Wow.
So let's say if an emergency had happened like immediately, well, in terms of the time scale to make something on that big of a mass level, I guess, big of a level, it will take too much time. Mm. So I guess it will be, in this stage, it's more like, you know, on a practical level, but hopefully over time it can be like improved.
So I understand. I understand you're going to graduate school. Do you plan to sort of refine this as you move along in your studies?
I don't. So after I graduate, I'll still be at my university for over the summer. So I'll still be engaged in the research. But once I go to graduate school, I'll plan to pursue other things.
All right. Well, DeMarcus Robinson, thank you very much. From Tallahassee, Florida, environmental science major, Florida A&M. We appreciate your time and really interesting stuff you've done. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me bring another voice in here. Actually, in the studio is our on-point intern, Emily Sherio. She's double major in mediated communication and English at Stonehill College. She's from Auburn, Maine. And she not only wrote a senior thesis, she produced this hour of On Point, which means she found and identified our guests. Great to have you, Emily. Thank you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having
me. Such a great job on this program and here at On Point. We're glad that you're here. So your thesis is titled A Comparison Study of the Wardrobes of the Women of Fox News and MSNBC. Tell us what you looked at.
Yeah, so what really inspired me to do this research, I remember watching a documentary called Misrepresentation, which is all about representations of women in the media. And Katie Couric was featured and was there reflecting on her own experience being a broadcast journalist, and then started to observe that a lot of current women within the broadcast journalism field, she said, they dress like cocktail waitresses. And I think that's a big statement to make. And so I'm interested in representations of women in the news, but I'm also someone who really, really pays attention to the news and current events. So I thought it was a great medley to take on.
So you spent 5 consecutive weeks watching cable news for your thesis.
This might be the most grueling process of everyone.
Forget
we've heard.
The thesis. What did that do to your life?
No. Well, I will say that I watched more cable news in 5 weeks than anyone ever should, but it was definitely an interesting process to just see news from 2 separate networks.
So tell me about the scoring system that you came up with for your thesis.
Yeah, so the way that it worked, there's actually no previous research that quantifies this type of qualitative data, so that creating that method was kind of difficult. But I looked at the areas of the arms, the chest, and the legs. And so if a woman was wearing, say, a sleeveless shirt or a sleeveless dress, she would get a score of 1. If she was revealing her cleavage, she would get a score of 1. And if she was showing her legs, she would get a score of 1. So the most a woman could get in one sitting was a score of 3 points.
And so what were your results?
Yeah. So the average for MSNBC was 0.4 over the course of 5 weeks, and the average for Fox News was 1.01. So it was a very significant difference between both networks.
0.4 for MSNBC, Fox 1.01. So there was actually a difference in how the networks physically framed female hosts, right, on the screen. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So on MSNBC, I remember watching it on any given day, and the way that the camera would frame the woman was typically from the waist up. So in essence, you didn't even know if her legs were even visible, because the camera made a very distinct decision to only show her upper torso. Whereas on Fox News, they kind of call it the Roger Ailes angle, where the camera starts very, very low on the women's legs and eventually makes their way up to a full body shot.
Wow. McKay?
You know, it's funny, as with every other thesis we heard about today, I don't have that much experience in being a woman on cable news. That said, I do spend a decent amount of time in green rooms and makeup rooms going on cable news. And one of the kind of running jokes among fellow journalists I know who are women, they'll say that when they go on Fox, they get the Fox News treatment. So their hair gets blown out often. They get much heavier makeup done in the makeup room there than they would at other networks. Is it your sense that this is this is kind of a top-down, deliberate aesthetic that's being enforced by the network, or does it seem like people who, you know, just who go work at Fox versus MSNBC just tend to gravitate toward particular aesthetics or particular wardrobes?
Right. Well,
good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when you look at the amount of women on Fox News who are consistently getting these high scores, I think it kind of alludes to that this may be a systemic problem within the network.
I'm curious, as you are sitting here as a would-be journalist, how did you personally respond to the results of your thesis?
In terms of the data that I saw within Fox News, it was really disturbing, because I think women have spent a really long time trying to carve their own space within the world of journalism. And it is really difficult for a woman, especially on TV, because it's obviously a very visual medium, to want to look attractive and put together, but also look professional at the same time. So there's a fine line that they really need to walk.
Graduation is a few weeks away. We've got you here at On Point for the moment. We hope we can keep you. What are your plans after Stonehill?
So I would love to get into the radio journalism field at the moment. But I think in the long run, this thesis was really great in terms of testing to see if I would want to do research in the future. I think I can definitely see myself down the road getting a PhD in media studies and becoming a professor.
Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for
having
me.
Great to have you, and great work on this program as well. Thank you. Emily Shero, she's a student, 21-year-old from Auburn, Maine, from Stonehill College. Emily, thanks. Let's go back to the phones. Kevin is here from Bloomfield, Connecticut. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Hi, I'm well. Go ahead. Did you write a thesis?
Yes, I did. I graduated from the University of Connecticut last May, and I focused my thesis on implementing green energy technologies, specifically on college campuses.
And what did you learn?
Well, essentially, it was an exploration of more the cultural aspect of how people perceive energy technologies, but also more of a technical side of exploring the idea of using smaller college campuses essentially as small-scale models for larger areas. Especially in Connecticut, a very high-density population like the University of Connecticut, like UConn, compared to the rest of the state, would be able to use that as a model for how to shape and how to form different microgrids and utilize solar or utilize wind power and take that model to apply it to a larger scale like Hartford or Bridgeport or New Haven.
So, Kevin, I have a couple of questions here from callers. David wants to know, how do you determine what makes a good or meaty topic for a senior thesis? How did you decide?
To be honest, I chose something that I was passionate about and I would not have to, drag on with the work.
Okay, that's honest.
It's much easier to write on a topic when you really enjoy it. From my personal experience, writing a 20, 30, 40-page paper on something that you do not like is very difficult. So I think that was one of the major parts of it.
Good for you. Glad you called, Kevin, and all the best. Let me get Marianne in here from New Orleans, Louisiana. Hi, Marianne. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I got my MFA in video documentaries from the University of New Orleans 17 years ago, and I did a documentary on the oral history along the River Road between Baton Rouge and New Orleans and the African American and Native American communities. And I was pregnant with my second son, on bed rest, had to get special dispensation to defend my thesis. It was shown to 500 people in Bastrop, Louisiana. That one of the people who had been, his job as a boy was to drive the horse and cart for the teacher in the African-American community. He got a standing ovation.
Wow.
I heard about it because I was on bed rest. And then flash forward to today, I wanted to do some work with our Human Trafficking Commission. They wanted to see some of my work. And I had given all my raw material, transcripts, video to the Amistad Center down at Tulane University.
Yeah.
And I found out that other people have been using my work as a primary source.
Oh, wow.
And now it's digitized and it's in their permanent collection.
Wow, so that's very gratifying. Oh, that's a great story, Marianne. Thank you very much. Our time is almost up here. McKay Coppins, thank you so much for being with us. What was your takeaway from hearing these terrific students and their theses?
You know, obviously they're all very impressive. And I think that my takeaway is I kind of wish BYU did require, you know, both of our alma maters.
Yeah.
I wish they did require senior theses. I think the caller who said it before was right. Very few people get a chance to go this in depth on anything in their life. They should take advantage.
Well, after hearing these students, makes you feel good about the next generation. That is
right.
For sure. McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic. Great to have you with us, McKay. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Listeners, thanks to you as always. I'm Jane Clayson. Have a good weekend. This is On Point.